Welcome, everyone. I'm going to use this because I have to sing tonight, so I won't be yelling at you for 2 hours. Is that okay? Oh, good. Okay. So I found a beautiful poem that relates to the Soham Hamsa mantra that we just did in the last class. So welcome to the new people, actually. Is it just Regan and Leanne? Anyone else? Oh, they'll catch up. Sorry? Yes. But new this class, no, because you were here last time. Yeah, so we will do a little bit of review, but in the last class we were talking about a mantra for the most stupid, what was it called? The mantra, even for the very stupid or something like that. So there's a mantra that we're all doing all the time, and it's the mantra of the breath. So it's the natural mantra of the in and out breath. You've probably done this actually at the ashram, because sometimes in the yoga nidra we hear the sound of soham, hamsa, the inward moving breath, the sound that that makes, and the outward going breath, the natural sound that that makes. And so if that's our natural mantra, you could say that we are always practicing to the divine naturally. So this is one of the nice things about practice, is actually as you move through it, it begins quite difficult for us sometimes. We have so much information and trying so hard to integrate and trying so hard to practice every day. And actually when we begin, it's very difficult. But one of the things that I've really enjoyed as the years have gone by is that it just seems to be more and more easy, and they point out to you the things that you're already naturally doing that are bringing you naturally to awakening, or to show you that awakening is always there. And the sort of mystical aspect of the breath is that it's a natural prayer that we're doing all the time. It's a natural mantra that we're always saying all the time. And you say your name to yourself does not have to instigate that at all. You know? So when you think about how difficult practice is, it's always like, I've got to get myself to the cushion, you know? I didn't do my mantras. I have to. I didn't. I have to. I should. You know, practice sounds like that a lot, right? And then actually, in these kinds of practices, they show you that you could see that there's natural devotion, there's natural practice that's happening all the time, because you don't have to say to yourself, oh, breathe in, oh, breathe out, quick, oh, breathe in. Right? If we did that, we'd be exhausted, and that's all we'd be doing. That would be life. Reminding ourselves to breathe in and out. And same with the heart. We'll talk about the heart later, but they call that the unstruck sound. You don't keep saying to yourself, oh, beat again, quick, beat again. It's a natural process of the body and breath. And so the natural mantra of soham, I am that. The natural mantra, soham, I am that, is the natural namaste that we give to ourselves and the universe all the every second that we breathe. This is what we mean when we say Hari Om. I see the light in you that's also in me. And that's the same as soham, I am that. That's a quality of practice where you recognize that everything is already accomplished already. Everything is already accomplished. And when we recognize that, we'll realize that there was never anything to do. That's really one of the beautiful ways that we can approach practice, is recognizing that you have everything you need already. Everything is already accomplished. And when you say, I am that, you can ignite that potential and recognize that truth. So here is the Hamsa is the swan, and the Soham is I am that. This is from Kabir, translated by Robert Bly. Swan, I'd like you to tell me your whole story, where you first appeared and what dark sand you are going toward, and where you sleep at night and what you are looking for. It's morning, swan, wake up, climb in the air, follow me. I know of a country that spiritual flatness does not control, nor constant depression, and those alive are not afraid to die. There, wildflowers come up through the leafy floor, and the fragrance of I am that floats on the wind. There the bee of the heart stays deep inside the flower and cares for no other thing. So you see how they've used the swan and the I am that in that poem? Yeah, the swan is Saraswati's ride. So her Cadillac is the swan. And she's the goddess that we sort of invoke for deepening our connection to our speech and artistry, creativity, song, teaching. Yeah. So I thought I'd just share that with you. So here's another syllable. Here's another primordial sound. And I wanted to do this one with you today because actually my friend Maddie here, who I've known for maybe 10 years or so, or more, probably more than that actually, we were just laughing today about how, like, I remember now, sometimes Maddie would just call me and he'd just go, and then just hang up because that's all he wanted to say, you know. So we had this thing where you just go, and you just make this sort of like weird noise. And it was just this way to sort of connect with your buddy and make each other laugh, and then you didn't have to actually say anything else, and then you just hang up, and that was cool. Just talk to Maddie for the day, you know. But actually, ah is this primordial sound. And like om, the sound ah is considered to be one of the most sacred sounds of the universe. So Marut was talking today about how really when you go deeper into the cosmos, the universe, it's vibrating and it's sound, it's pure sound. You know, all of this talk we've been, you know, talking about interdependence, well, as things move together like that, they must be making sound, right? Things moving together, things vibrating together, that there must be some underlying sound that's being made, or that the planets turning, you know, must be making some incredible primordial sound, the fact that the universe is moving like that, you know. And so ah is considered the root of all language because ah gives all consonants life. It breathes life into all consonants. So if you think of, like Marit was saying the other day, like if you're saying K, you see, if you don't have the aspiration, it's just K, right? K, say the ah. So the ah is this primordial sound that breathes life into consonants. And breathing life into consonants means that we can speak, and speaking means that we can name things, and naming things means that we can give birth to the world. So ah is the beginning of all creation. You know, in the beginning was the word, but even before the word was spoken is ah. It's breathing life into consonants. Breathes life into sound. It helps you make sound. So ah. When we say ah, the sound comes from the sort of back of our throat. We'll practice it. But if you just try it now, it's ah, ah. You can feel ah. It comes through the back of your throat. It releases the soft palate. And up there, it sort of connects you to the subtle bodies. Ah. You can feel it sort of vibrating a bit at the top of your head. These root chakras that we have, these sort of points of vibration and power in the body, ah, you kind of get into the central channel, the sushumna there. So the sort of power source of your body is ignited by saying ah. It's also, just practically speaking, it helps you release the jaw. So again, ah, ah. So now Victoria can tell us a bit about the jaw. The jaw is so tight. I don't know if you know this about your own jaw, but I guarantee that all through listening to the teachings, we've been like, mostly we listen like that. So if you start to massage here at the jawline, It might be like it feels when someone massages and gets deep into your shoulders. Can you feel it? If you stick your thumbs in there, you can feel how much tension. Is anyone not feeling tension at all? And some people don't have like even a loose jaw that you can even move that, you know. So we hold so much tension here in the face, you know, the brow line. So here it's so good to just release the face, release the jaw, so that the tension is released there. So also helps you release tension that we're holding in the head. This is, you know, the way that we communicate with each other is so much through the face, right? So it's good to have access to all of the ways that we can be expressive towards each other, because that's one of the ways that we communicate with each other, that we are together. We look at each other in the eyes and we, you know, when we speak, we're going to look at speech today. Speech is a really important part of the yoga of sound, but speech is also communicated through the body. So if I say to you, I'm fine, right? I've said to you, I'm fine. Why don't you think I'm fine? I'm fine. Well, I'm fine. You know, words aren't actually as important sometimes as all the other things that we bring to it, like the face and the expression and so on. So when we release the tension in the face, we're actually able to communicate with each other more, which is part of our practice, is becoming more in tune with each other, able to be connected to each other, loving each other more and so on. That's all expressed through things like the face and the jaw. It relates to the area of the throat. So those of you that were in asana class today, I don't know if you noticed, but Andrew has been subtly opening the throat for us. So remember our Garuda poses? He was getting us a lot to open up here. And this area of the throat, we barely think of it, do we? But this opening, this area of the throat, gives you this clear passage between the mind and the body. Actually, these two major parts of our being, of our doors of expression, the body and mind, we're trying to get body and mind in sync with each other, right? But that's all passes through this area of the throat and the speech and the ability to translate what's in the mind to the body. I like to think about it with practice, because when we practice, we have all these great ideas. I should be nice to other people. I should stop stealing. I should stop hitting people. You know, we have all these great ideas of what we should do with the body, but they don't translate into the body. And one of the ways you can think about translating these good ideas into the body is that it has to pass through this area of interpretation and communication through the throat. So it is actually really important to open up this throat area, feel this area nice and clear, free from tension, free from constriction. So opening, so again, if you can feel it resonating in the base of the throat, opening up that too, so releasing all the tension in the throat. You know, I've had a few friends lately that have had problems with their thyroid, isn't it, here? You know, so it's really good for you to keep stretching that out so that your thyroid gets nice and clear, squeezed out like a sponge, you know, stretched out. It's healthy to do these exercises in asana poses that Andrew's been doing, to opening up the throat. The fish pose we did at the end of class too, right? The sound of emptiness, they say. It's the sound of emptiness. It represents emptiness. Like Om represents everything, you could say Ah represents emptiness. It represents speech. So when you talk about Om and Ah, then there's a third syllable, Hung, which goes together. So Om, Ah, Hung are also three syllables that go together that represent body, speech and mind. And in that interpretation, relates to your speech. So it's a way to remember the importance of speech. When you say reminds you of the importance of speech. Can remind us of the sound retreat, to get more in touch with the vibrations of the universe, right? It's also the sound we make when the mind stops, you know, like the Chikita mudra that Marut was talking about today, see? So make that sound when you're, when the mind stops, which is a replication of the goal, that when the vrittis have nirodha, you go, ah! You make that sound, and actually ah is also a sound of enlightenment. So that, you know, there are stories of when someone gets enlightened, they say ah or aho in the Ashtavakra. Who said that? Good on you. Ah! In the Ashtavakra Gita. So what does he say, Leanne? Aho, that's right. Aho. Yes, so like the songs of realization, like the song of realization that Milarepa sings when he becomes enlightened and he just spontaneously starts singing and then spends the rest of his life singing to people, like that when King Janaka becomes awakened, he says, aho. You know, instead of say, because if you say, I have awakened, it's not quite accurate. You know, the language, because you know now that the language is tripping you up. Because I could never get awakened, because I is the thing that's in way of your awakening. I is the separate self that is completely stopping us from being awakened into we. You know, so if you can't say, oh, I am awakened, you just say, ah, oh. Ah, oh, okay. Oh, yeah. It's always been there. Ah. It's the sound we make when we are born. Ah. Not again. Round 10. Ding, ding, ding. It's the sound we make in orgasm or pleasure when we have pleasure. Ah. It's the sound we make when we die with our final breath. So, ah, the sacred syllable, ah. Have I convinced you how cool ah is? You know what, who I think of too is Michael Jackson. When you listen to Michael Jackson, he's all, yeah, exactly. Ah. You know, because his whole, like, being was so full of music and, you know, he's so expressive of that level, the level that we had between that in the myth kind of level, or the maybe even the mantra level, but you know, Michael Jackson, you just can't like get out the words because it's just, he wants to express everything. So it's that sound of trying to express rather than with silence or with words. So we find that middle space of expression. This is from Kabir as well. Breathe in that word out of which the whole Milky Way has come. That word is your teacher. I heard that sound and I am its disciple. How many are there alive who have taken in its meaning? Listen, student, hold to that word, do it. All the old texts and holy poems shout about it. The world has its deep roots in that word. The rishis and the devotees babble about it, but no one grasps how mysterious the word is. The father gets up from supper and walks out when he hears it. The ascetic returns to love when he hears it. The six great systems keep laying it all out. The animal of renunciation drives toward that word. The world with all its elephants and microbes has jumped out of that word. Inside the word, everything is full of light. True, Kabir says, true. But who knows where the word comes from the first place? So there's a concept, who knows where the word comes from in the first place, with the heart that I was talking about before. The beating of the heart, sometimes they refer to as the unstruck sound. And like I was saying with the breath, the heart is sometimes referred to. Anahata is the Sanskrit name for the heart. Anahata means unstruck sound. So the beating of the heart that was never struck. There was no first striking of the heart. It's like getting to the heart of the matter or something like that. Anahata. There's sort of a sense of it being a primordial sound. There's an expression, primordial mind, that we sometimes talk about. Your primordial mind, meaning your innate, clear, luminous awareness. The innate, clear, luminous awareness that was never born and will never die, that we all share, you know, what we're bowing to when we say Hari Om. That's your primordial mind. You could say that's really what's calling us home. That's where we're trying to get back to, is to recognize our innate, clear, primordial mind. And sometimes the teachings maybe suggest that exists in relationship to a primordial sound, so you can understand being that primordial sound that the primordial mind is singing. So I got a little bit mystical there, but let's get back to and actually do it. And what I just thought we should try it. And again, like Marut was saying with the Om, just to do it with your own breath. And if you like, you can find your tone so it can become a harmonic chant. So find where your ah wants to come from. We can start together, but as the breath moves in and out naturally, you can sing your ah in whatever tone or voice you like. And don't be afraid. I mean, I was sitting up the back, so I couldn't quite tell, but it sounded to me a little bit like the Om's were quite soft. And with the ah, try and let the body express the ah that it wants to, the primordial sound of you, to try and find our inner song, right? The retreat isn't actually called the yoga of sound, it's called inner song, a retreat on the yoga of sound. But it would be nice for us to be more in touch with our inner song, like what is singing inside of you, wouldn't that be nice to know? So to be able to hear that a little bit through our voice. Okay, so breathing in together.
Ah.
breathe in that word out of which the whole Milky Way has come. So with something like ah, we recognize the sound that comes before the syllables, that comes before the word. You know, you're really breaking down the words that we use, the language that we use is really the grossest form of speech. And this sound ah breathes life into every syllable, and those syllables make up words. So we're going deeper and deeper into this aspect of speech. Underneath ah is breath, underneath breath is prana, underneath prana is emptiness. You know, so it's using our whole body, and as we allow that to come forth, the ah breathes life into those syllables, which breathes life into language itself. And language is this sacred way that we create our world, that we understand our world, that we put meaning on our world, you know. And so the ah helps us remember that all acts of speech can be sacred. And that's why we think so deeply about speech in our ethical living, our ethical guidelines that we're trying to sort of design for ourselves so that our life is less suffering and more full of liberation. The speech aspect is so important. And you can see from that, do you feel that with the R? Can you see that it's underneath syllables, which are, and even it's underneath words, which is underneath syllables, which are, you know, ignited by the breath. Do you feel that? That it sort of reminds you of how sacred speech could be? How important it is, the way that we name things? How important the tone of voice is when we speak to each other and so on. There's so much we could work with there, with the yoga sound and with the practice of speech. One of our doors of expression, of the three main doors of expression, that's one of them. And I don't think we think about it as much as body and mind, right? Body and mind, we usually say, what makes you up, body and mind? But speech is the joining sort of energetic force in the middle there. When you divide out body, speech and mind in the Buddhist tradition, they relate that to the three bodies of the Buddha, the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya and the Nimanakaya too. I'm not going to go into it, but for those of you that have studied Buddhism, the Dharmakaya relates to mind, and the Nimanakaya relates to body, and the Sambhogakaya relates to speech. And the Sambhogakaya is the sort of aspect of the Buddha they almost describe as like holographic. So again, that sound and light show that we talked about yesterday, that's where speech can get us to. The gross speech, what I'm doing now, is pointing us to the subtle speech. And the subtle speech is where exists true realization. Realization comes in that subtle aspect. So, Evam Maya Shrutam. Do you remember this mantra? Evam Maya Shrutam. Once I heard this, the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Cutter Sutra, where we got mantras from in the last class, they begin with that mantra, Evam Maya Shrutam. This is what I heard, or they say, once I heard this, which is quite nice because it sort of sounds like once upon a time. So a sutra, which this is one of the main texts of a particular school of Buddhism, a sutra means it's spoken by the Buddha, okay? There's other aspects of it, but really they're from the Buddha. It's like the Buddha's teachings are sutras, okay? So it's interesting that in the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Cutter Sutra, it doesn't say Buddha said this. The sutra doesn't begin, the Buddha said this. It begins, once I heard this. Because of this aspect of listening as well. Remember Milarepa, listening, hearing the teachings all the time. And those two sutras of the mantras that we're doing, of the Diamond Cutter Sutra and the Heart Sutra, they begin, once I heard this, one of the reasons they begin that way is to remind us that revelation is available all the time. So they don't say, the Buddha said this, because that would locate us in a time when the historical Buddha lived. So instead, these later sutras, they say, once I heard this, because they're not saying, I was back in time when the historical Buddha lived, and that's the only time someone ever said anything worth listening to. They say, once I heard this, so that we remember that the revelation of Buddha, which is different to the Buddha, the revelation of Buddhahood is available always, anytime, anywhere, for anybody. So revelation is imminent. Revelation is not something that happened 2,500 years ago to a certain set of lucky people that actually got to meet the Buddha. Once I heard this means, once upon a time, I went to the shopping centre and the woman behind the grocery counter said something really amazing, and it's worthy of a sutra, Revelation is available all the time. So they're grabbing the Buddha by his necktie and dragging the energy of revelation into the present to let us know that revelation is available all the time. Once I heard this. So I thought to wake us up a little bit, we could listen to what we've heard so far. Like I call it, crowdsourcing. So crowdsourcing the retreat. And so just so that we can hear what each other has heard, because we think we know what's been said, but when you hear what other people have heard, you realise how many different prisms people have been listening through. So it doesn't have to be accurate, it doesn't have to be word for word. What have you heard so far in the retreat? Om. Good. Everything. Oh, you've heard everything, have you? Om, yep.
R is the underlying sound. The sound arises.
R is the underlying sound. Yes.
R brings out the breath, but then brings out the double.
Yes. Rides on the breath, which breathes life into the consonants, which makes the syllables, which makes the words, which creates the universe. Yeah, nice.
The mantra about breath.
The mantra of the in-breath and out-breath, yeah, that we're doing naturally 21,600 times a day. Some of us have a practice where we're supposed to say a mantra 21 times a day. I'm like, 21 times. That's a good one because you're doing it naturally 21,600 times.
That we're connecting to our primordial sound.
Connecting to our primordial sound.
And then when we did the actual
yes.
I didn't actually hear anybody else except my own.
Ah.
And then it actually was different to what I was, the sound that I was hearing was different to what was coming out of my mouth.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah,
that's like, so you were hearing something within, yeah. And yeah.
Like foreign.
Yes. Oh, that's nice, Rose. Mm-hmm. Did it feel vibratory when I was doing the art? My belly was really vibrating.
Yeah, the belt was like, yeah. In the belly.
Yes, in the belly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It also, when I could, when I was breathing in slowly, I could hear the R's, and it reminded me, when there's movies and they show the dawn of time, and sometimes they have oh, it sounded a bit like that. What else have you heard?
The spiritual practice is readily available through connecting with the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Becoming more conscious of the sound, not just sound.
Yes.
The sound that you're making, the sound, the way that you're hearing and interpreting.
Yeah.
Sound by tuning into those sacred sounds because they are there.
Yes.
And so then you're connecting that through the chakras of the body.
Yep.
Really,
yes, yeah. Yeah, we're going to do a bit more chakra work tomorrow, so we'll be able to move through more specifically areas of the body and try and open them up through sound. Has there been... Yes, sorry, Marie.
I just thought that the sonic spectrum was really cool.
Yes.
Understanding the three different aspects of sound and how they're all beautifully related and linked to...
Yeah, the sonic spectrum.
Yeah, it was really great to understand.
Yeah, which included that silence part at the end as well. Yeah.
I like the bit about that power comes not necessarily from the words, but from the source. Like, the sound is of the mantras are not in and of themselves, you know, that they don't have a, you know, pulling the conceptual mind off of that and loosening up that grip.
That the meaning of the mantra is the mantra itself, you mean, rather than there being meaning overlaid on it? Yeah.
And connecting with the source.
Yes.
Yeah.
The more you listen, the more you learn.
The more you listen, the more you learn. Yeah, I thought that was really interesting today. So remember, Marit was talking about listening and saying that you can hear things but not... was it you can listen to things but not really hear them, you know, other way around. You can hear things but not be listening. So I don't know if you found this sometimes when someone's talking on the phone or you're in a conversation and you've been hearing the sounds but you actually can't remember what they've been saying because you've been speaking to yourself or, you know, been distracted. It's the same with reading. Like sometimes I'll be reading like an article or something and I'll realise like I'm turning the page and I actually have no idea, but my eyes have been scanning the words, you know. So there's a awareness of the words, but the attention is not engaged. There's an awareness of the words on the page, but attention has not been engaged so that you're actually reading or you're actually seeing that. So same with listening, right? It's like Charlie Brown's teacher, you know. Wah, 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 wah. And haven't heard anything. You just, the attention hasn't been there. So it's just been sound with no attention. Do you like the poems?
Yeah.
I think it's nice in the afternoon to read some poems. So the word. This is from an anthology of Sufi poetry called The Drunken Universe, and the Kabir poems is Ecstatic Poems by Kabir. This one is an anthology of Sufi poems because I thought it'd be nice to include some Islamic poetry to remember that they have this beautiful esoteric tradition full of love and full of exactly what we've been talking about. So, the word speech is the preface to the book of love, treasury of the king of love, the bounty you seek from the heart. What have I said? Whatever you say is logos, ocean fountain, pearl hoard, incisive proof of the intellect whose cutting edge is but the blade of the tongue, which reveals the hidden fires, which sears the universe with the heart's candle flame. If the word were not painted on the cosmic page, there would be no sign of Adam or the world, no talk of past or future. Who could have kindled mercy in the heart of the thief of hearts? Who could have made Muslims out of infidels, or made the minstrels rejoice, or sparked 1,000 flames with a single breath? Logos is revelation, and we are the high throne. Speech is magic, and we are the enchanters. Life flows from eloquent speech. Where is there room for the miracles of Jesus? For with this breath, we enliven a whole universe and render it everlasting. So they know what they're talking about too. So I thought, let's talk about speech. Just to finish off, and I'll get you to talk as well, because I know people get tired at this time of day. So I did that one. There's Mila Raper. Yeah. Is that up there? Because it's a different size. Yeah, okay. So what time am I finishing? 5:15, okay. If you want more mantras, they have a haven at 5:30. Are people enjoying the mantra practice and the chanting and everything? Yeah, okay. Yes,
speak. Jane was saying if you could sing that last mantra again.
Oh. Sure. Yeah. The Taraka Timi Ram Dipo.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so yogash chitta vritti nirodha. What does yogash chitta vritti nirodha mean? What have you been getting from that?
Stopping at the mental afflictions, the vrittis.
Stopping the vrittis, yeah. Yoga is stopping the churning of the mind. The point of yoga is to stop the perversions of the mind. The point of yoga is to stop the continual chatter of the mind. Swami Atma says the point of yoga is to stop all unnecessary thoughts. You know, she's very practical. So I see her in my mind as saying, that's really unnecessary, you know. For most of the things that are in my mind, it's unnecessary, you know. All that chatter is unnecessary. You know, no, you're not going to Dalesford for a latte. Unnecessary. Unnecessary. And when the churnings of the mind cease, the natural peace is revealed, and our natural birthright of bliss is revealed. You know, we are able to live in our natural state of bliss and peace. So yogash chitta vritti nirodha. So the churning of the mind is something that we can really connect to when we're in silence. Have you been experiencing that in your silence? We talked about this last retreat and I thought we'd revisit it because it's very strong practice for people to be in silence for hours at a time, and we're probably not used to it. So how's that been for you to be in silence?
Not long enough.
Not long enough. Yeah. Sorry?
A relief,
yeah.
Yeah, just not having to communicate all the time.
Yeah, good. Has anyone found it difficult?
I found that it's gone in waves.
Mm-hmm.
From being that sense of relief and being at rest with the peace and going, oh, this is fantastic. And then it's like the little monkey in there just gets bored. Oh, I've had enough of this now. Can we do something?
Let's right.
Do something.
And what do you think it is that it wants to do?
I think Maurice often talked about that thing where there's constant stimulus,
yeah.
Screens or you yeah. know, there's something to entertain you,
mm-hmm.
keep it busy.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's still, it's like, well,
yeah. what? Yes.
Can't stay like this.
Yeah.
It's got to be busy.
Yes, yeah.
There's an aversion almost to the quiet.
Yes. That's right. I think that's right. And I think that's a really great thing for us to all look at is what is it that we don't want to stay with when we're quiet? You know, so when you're in the sort of internet life and the phone life and the Facebook life and everything, you can see like I think of the mind like a frog on lily pads. It's like, oh, a cat video. Oh, my friend's birthday. Oh, look, a wedding. You know, oh, they got married. I'll look at all their 500 photos and like them all. Oh, look, a funny video. And so the mind thinks that anything that takes your attention is worthy of your attention, and that's not true.
Cindy,
yeah.
I find it difficult to do silence when I'm unhappy.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. Because you're sort of caged into the continuing narrative of, yeah. So that, good, okay. So one of the ways, oh, sorry, Ian. Yeah.
I was going to say, silence when everybody else is around, I find myself heightened tuning into other forms of communication.
Like you what?
I find myself, if we can't talk, then I'm looking for other communication, you know, that's facial expression and whatever.
Oh, right, so you're still looking to communicate with each other, but in other ways.
We're all doing the same thing.
Yes. Yeah. Which is an appropriate way to be in silence, according to Susan that was here last time, she was saying that, you know, they do encourage that at the ashram, that you don't just sort of close in on yourself, but you recognise ways for us to be together without words so that we can deepen our sense of communication. Because we do communicate with each other in so many other ways, but we just rely on speech. So, yeah, I think that that's quite nice to sort of... It's almost like I did five rhythms the other day, and I know this is one thing you sort of do in contemporary dance or improvisation, is that you sort of recognise what people are doing around you when they're dancing and you try and sort of move with them, you know. So you see someone's done that with this with their arm and you sort of do underneath and that kind of thing. So you sort of move with each other in that way that's communicating on more of an energetic level instead of the speech level. So I don't think that's necessarily, you know, negative when you're in silence. I think it's good to do both, but I think it is really nice to see. Because my friend who was in a long-term retreat, she always says that silence is not the absence of language, it's another language. So you're learning how to be with each other. You're learning a new language with each other when you're in silence, new way of communicating. Yeah. But yeah, it is challenging because you can't, it's when you're not happy to be in silence because you can't break out of the narrative of the mind very easily. So let's have a look at ways that we can sort of work with that a bit. Does anyone else feel like that? That they're sort of get trapped in the cycle? Get trapped in the narrative cycle? Here's a little practice to do. When the mind starts churning, the vrittis are not Narodaha in. So, when you're in silence, the negative narrative begins, and I'll do my usual train metaphor. So, you come into contact, right? This is the way that they talk about the cycle in Buddhism. You come into contact with somebody's facial expression, for instance, when you're in silence, you know. Like you smile at someone and they don't smile back. Or you come into contact with a thought in your own mind. You loser, nobody likes you. Okay. So you make contact first. Contact. And the contact produces an unpleasant feeling inside you. We'll use this example. The contact, someone doesn't smile back, everybody hates you in the mind, whatever it is that you come into contact with produces an unpleasant feeling in you, right? So I like to think of it as when that happens, like the contact happens and the unpleasant arises, then it's like the cogs of a train begin. Like the steam engine. You know, it's not because you sort of get that in your face too, like you smile at someone and they don't smile back, it's like. And you've got no evidence. There's no reason why, you know, you especially when you can't talk, there's nothing you can do. So begins. Because of unpleasant, so one of our major problems is that we cannot sit with unpleasant. We do not have the capacity to sit with unpleasant feelings. And one way you can understand that is when we still exist, when we still run on a survival-based system. When I say system, I'm talking about our body and mind. Our body and mind, our nervous systems are still running on survival instincts. We're like animals. And if you think about it from an evolutionary point of view, one of the teachers that I really like, he says, we have an evolutionary hangover. We're in the evolutionary hangover. You know, and evolutionary means that we've been running on fight, flight, freeze. These are our, like, after millions of years, our brilliant responses to what happens in life are fight back, run away, or freeze. like an animal. That's how, that's what we've developed so far. Millennia. Okay, so we're in the evolutionary hangover of not really thinking through the possibilities of when, like, Victoria gives me the stink eye. I've got three possibilities. I'll slap her in the face. I'll run away and never speak to her again. Or like an animal does when it feels like it's in danger. You see it, it's like, I'll just pretend I'm not here. We went for a walk. It's so funny because Marut thinks that the animals in Australia are hilarious. My mother thinks they're actually quite, like, dim. You know, because, no, but really actually talking about the evolutionary, like, because they have not had many predators, you know, they're not that fussed about fight and flight. You know, so we were going for a walk and we walked past a echidna and he was like, oh no. And then he just like stuck his head in some leaves. We're like, we can see you. It's just like, it's like, this is brilliant. So the evolutionary hangover of Australian animals is just like, cover your eyes. But so do you understand that? Like the survival-based instincts of fight, flight and freeze are not functional, you know? That they're animalistic, but those are the sort of responses that we have to unpleasant. So we have to develop our capacity to recognise when things feel unpleasant and put in new responses. So this is really what you could understand karma as, is to release the habitual responses of fight, flight and freeze, so that when I see a stink eye from Victoria, I have many other possibilities of interpretation, and I've put a wrench in the cogs of the train that are beginning, that you stick a wrench in there and start a new response, so that you start building up habits of new responses to unpleasant. Does this make sense? Unpleasant. When unpleasant happens, we put a wrench in the cogs of the train and try and put in a new response, so that we get out of the evolutionary hangover of fight, flight, freeze. So when we're in silence, for instance, we come into contact with something, unpleasant arises, and then if you do not recognize it, the ksh begins, and then the next step is exaggeration and proliferation. So the ksh means the train's just about to leave the station and you decide whether or not to get on the train. If you get on the train, that means ksh. Victoria's actually like, what's wrong with her? Now that I think about it, you know, she spent 2 days before she replied to my text. Next time Victoria comes up to me, I'm not even going to speak to her. And actually, you know what? Nobody at this retreat likes me. In fact, nobody's ever liked me in my whole life. And basically you're taking yourself to justification station, you know. And justification station is, yeah, Victoria is an inherently irritating person. And I am allowed to, you know, hit her back, criticise her back, yell at her, you know. Justification station, you've spent that whole time on the train and the vrittis have just been, and she did that, and she did that, and that. You start making your little list of slights, and the ego, that's the ego's job. That's what you have signed the ego up for. The ego is sitting in the train going, and then you probably got one for your partner. They didn't say thank you for dinner. And then, they didn't wash the dishes. And I left them all night to see if they'd wash them in the morning, and they didn't. The ego's like that, you know. It's just got its hand up on its hips saying, how dare you? How dare you? This is the separate self. This is the illusion of separation. The ego is like campaigning for the illusion of separation all the time. You know, so when you feel that outrage, how dare they? And the outrage of... It leads you to the bigger sort of understanding of yourself in the world, the bigger illusory understanding of yourself in the world, which is nobody loves me. That's what it's trying to justify. Nobody likes me. Victoria's look wouldn't affect me if I had some sense of love and respect for myself and others. It wouldn't bother me as much as it would when I don't like myself. When you don't like yourself and are feeling defensive, then if someone goes like that to you, you're like, what? How dare you, you know? Or you say, yep, of course, they don't like me either, because nobody does, you know? So this is our narrative. So you can see how this relates to speech. What do we think of ourselves? How are we talking to ourselves? How are we relating to ourselves? How does that work with how we relate to others as well. So one of the things you can do when you're silent and the cogs begin of the train is that you can try and remember three small steps. Okay, so stink eye with Victoria and her lovely lashes. How could she ever give you a stink eye? Sorry, Vic. No, but I mean, it could be the other way. I mean, it's not just the negative. It's also actually in the positive. Like, Victoria could smile at me and it could be, ksh. Yeah, Victoria thinks I'm amazing. I think Victoria, you know, she probably thinks I'm like the best teacher at the ashram. And actually, it's true. Like, I am better than Marit and Andrew. And I should actually, next retreat, I should actually ask them not to come. The justification station. Like, I don't need you guys. You know, so that the vrittis can come in those two main forms of the aversion and the grasping, the craving for more, more, more. I need more love if someone smiles at me. I need everybody to smile at me. I need everybody to like me all the time. And again, that's coming from that lack of self-respect, lack of self-love, you know, and ability to see that in others too. So here's a little practice. The cogs start. You come into contact with something, let's say unpleasant. Unpleasant arises. And instead of jumping on the train, instead of allowing the vrittis to really begin, say, please stop. So that's the first step. Please stop. You can say, please don't get on the train. Okay. You can kindly have to say all this to yourself kindly. Please stop. Please don't get on the train. This is really nice when you're in silence. You can just be really calm with yourself, you know. Or you can be like Swami Atma. Please don't go to Dalesford for a latte. So please stop. Please don't get on the train. That's number one. Just stop, okay? You know the train is not going to the destination that you want to go to. The train never reaches a good destination, all right? So don't trust the train. Never going to reach a good destination. It's going to reach depression station, you know. So please stop. Please get off the train. And the next one, please don't believe that thought. This is really important. Please don't believe that thought. What's the thought? Victoria hates me. Everybody hates me. I'm inherently unlovable. So you can look at the surface. The surface thought is something like, why did Victoria give me the stink eye? But what's underneath that? Underneath that is, why doesn't Victoria love me? Underneath that is, I feel inherently unlovable. Okay? And it's not true that you're inherently unlovable. What's true is that you are love. That's your true nature. You have to really believe that, you know, and that actually takes intellectual study, but it's true, I'll tell you. We are love. That's our true nature. We all are. We're all, you know, interdependence means that. And so we, that's who we are. And so it's not true that you're unlovable, but that's what we're running on. That's the survival-based instinct that we're running on. That's the trance of unworthiness, Tara Brach calls it, that we're living in. The trance of unworthiness. So please don't believe that thought is the next one. And when you're feeling depressed, you make yourself more and more depressed by those thoughts, you know. Nobody loves me, you know, I'm inherently unlovable is one of the base thoughts of depression. And it's not true, you know. It takes a lot of work to get out of it, but one of the ways we can at least release the grip of that unhappiness is to recognize it's just really not true. At base level, it's not true, okay? And it's not helpful to believe it. And I think sometimes we've gotten a little mixed up about how being, it's holy to beat ourselves up. We've become a little bit confused and think, you know, if there's a God, are they going to be looking at you thinking, oh, everybody hates me, I hate myself, and going, oh, my favourite disciple. Is that what they want for you, you know? No. They liked seeing us all dancing around in Andrew's class, you know, seeing us chanting and singing. The divine would be like, wow, they're expressing their true nature, awesome. They've recognised their natural birthright of bliss. It's our natural birthright to be happy. Okay, so we've somehow got it all mixed up and think it's really holy to put myself down, especially in Australia, I think. You know, we do have that tall poppy syndrome, and there's sort of a nice aspect to that of sort of every, you know, the level playing field and the mateship and everything. There's a nice aspect to it, but I think we take it too far, you know, to the point where it's like that self-flagellation, like, I am going to punish myself until I'm resurrected. You can't become resurrected through continual self-hatred and self-loathing. You know, it doesn't work like that. I'm a loser. I'm horrible. I hate myself. Everybody else hates me. Oh, I'm enlightened. No. You know, it just doesn't work like that. All right. So all that to say, please don't believe that thought. That train doesn't go anywhere good, and that thought's not true. Why do you want to believe untrue thoughts? We come to these retreats so we can get more in touch with reality. It's not real. It's not real that you're unlovable, okay? So please don't believe that thought. And then the third one is, and you can touch your chest when you say the third one, please come home. So call yourself back home. Much of the turbulence of the mind, much of the vrittis of the mind are about past and future. And past and future are not present home. So another way that we sort of have the self-loathing is that you go back into the past and, you know, the list, there's a whole list that you can bring up on your hard drive of everybody else who hasn't loved me in the past, everybody who's left me, everybody who's abandoned me, everybody who's abused me, right? So you've got a list there, evidence of how unlovable I am. That's all in the past. And the person that I'm with now, they're going to cheat on me, they're going to abandon me, they're going to leave me. You know, everybody, a list of like all the worries you have in the future. Neither of those are actually happening right now in the present. In the present, we're at an ashram in silence eating our breakfast. Why are we thinking of what happened to us 20 years ago and making ourselves upset about it? You know, so please come home. Call yourself back into the present. Call yourself back into integration, whatever the samadhi, the aspect of samadhi that you can reach at that moment, integrating body, speech and mind back into the present. Get off the train. It's not going anywhere good. You know, so please stop. Please don't believe that thought. And please come home. And you say, please come home kindly to yourself, like, come on, sweetie. Like you would a child, like, come on, honey, who's crying at the playground. Come on, let's go home. So that's an easy way for the vrittis to stop in the moment. and try it, as some of us have been doing it for a little while now, and it's really helpful. Does anyone have questions about that practice?
That's where mantra can come in.
Yeah. Yes. And
if you've had mantra that's taken you
in
that cycle, you could use it there.
Absolutely. Yeah, you can do an om or... Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice. And please come home. Ah. So add an ah mantra or an om mantra. Recalibrate, you know. All right. Well, do you want to talk about speech or are we getting tired? You what?
I'm good now.
Good now? You're all good, yeah. Well, let's see. Is there anything anybody wants to talk about? Oh, by the way, if you have, like, major questions, we have a Q&A box coming. And we'll have a Q&A session on Sunday. So if you have any major questions for any of us, then write them on the in the Q&A box and we can have a discussion on Sunday.
It can be about anything.
Yeah. Helen.
I've just got a comment. I just wrote down, please stop, please don't believe that thought, please come back home. And I thought, gee, that would have been good. I could have used that over the last few weeks with some stuff that's gone down at work.
Yeah.
And I remembered you'd said it at the last retreat, and I just noticed I started to beat myself up over it. So I just said, please stop, please don't believe that thought, and I thought, right, maybe.
That's great.
But,
see?
But look where I went so quickly.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. So that's a good thing to talk about. Because, you know, I was going to talk about speech and maybe we'll talk about gross speech again, although Marit's gone through the ethical guidelines around speech, okay? It's always good to go through them, though, just to keep clarifying and seeing what we're doing with our outer speech. But it's really important, the inner speech, you know, and you really can get connected to that when we're in silence, the inner speech. How do you talk to yourself?
Yeah.
If there was a broadcasting mechanism, megaphone, and people could hear the way you speak to yourself, would they be shocked? Would you speak to other people like that? You loser. Nobody likes you.
Stupid.
That was stupid. Idiot. Would you speak to anyone like that? You know, and maybe if we speak to ourselves like that enough, we do speak to other people like that. I mean, we do, right? When we get angry, when we get really angry, furious, some of the stuff that comes out of your mouth is appalling, right? Right. So in meditation, when you're in silence, there are those times you can really bring some awareness to the way that you're speaking to yourself and try and allow... Yeah, try and allow a voice, like a more friendly voice. Kalyana Mitra, have a nice friend in there. Nice mother figure, nice father figure, you know. Not angry dad, bitchy mum. I don't know where we get this from, but we, you know, especially those of us that are really anti-authoritarian, you know, we like screw the police and everything, but the way we speak to ourselves is really like, I've got a friend who said to me, I'm just really sick of the whole idea that someone's always wagging their finger in my face. And mostly that's me. You know? So are you always wagging the finger in the face with that authoritarian, like, angry dad voice? How are you speaking to yourself? Is there any way that you can speak to yourself more kindly, more friendly? I had a teacher that said, why don't you just try and put honey at the end of things, or sweetie, you know? So even if you're sort of trying to help yourself learn new techniques, like when you say, you stupid idiot, you know, maybe you've done something that you want to improve, like maybe you forgot to call someone and, you know, it really messed everything up. So instead of saying stupid idiot, you can say, okay, let's work out a method so that we don't do that anymore, honey. And then you're more likely to actually do it because you've got a friendly voice like helping you with your life. Okay, so inner voice, the way that you speak to yourself. So I thought, I don't know how you felt today in yoga with the group exercise. You like, yeah, okay, so you felt good? And the inner voice was good? Yeah. So that's great. Some of us in our group were saying that although we love and trust each other, you know, love and trust Andrew, there's some voice that comes up and goes, oh, shit, group exercise. Gonna have to touch people. Gonna have to look into people's eyes now, you know, which is so funny because, you know, when you, you know, studying Buddhism, for instance, like you say mantras like, I want to awaken with all other living beings. I wish all other living beings happiness. I wish all other living beings were free. You know, you try and open your heart with these mantras of connection, and yet when you, but not literally. Like, I don't literally want to touch someone else. You know, I literally want to hug someone. They might be sweaty, you know. So it's, you know, and I think it's good to hear that. You don't feel guilty about it. Like, that's not really your conscious voice. That's the fears rising up, you know. Oh, my God, group exercise. Oh, my God, sharing. Oh, my God, dancing around the room like an idiot. You know, that's confronting for some people, right? And what's so interesting is that, you know, so Marit was talking about it from his point of view, is that because he had to do that in Christian camp. So as an adult, you're like, oh, my God, Christian camp. You know, you have these associations. For me, it's just really, it feels uncool. So you can see what part of your ego it's attacking, you know, because, like, he calls me downtown because I'm, like, hipsterville town, you know. Like, I grew up trying to be cool. And if you're cool, you don't do that. Like, you don't skip around with people and, like, play hand slaps and, like, massage them and stuff. No, you know, not at all. And so, you know, all of those walls, all of that, those parts of personality, like, it's very confronting to do something that doesn't accord with all of these constructions that we've made about ourselves. And so the point is that the self-talk, like, people in our group realized that those thoughts would rush to the surface of stopping you from being free to do whatever you want to do. Like, why won't you let yourself be free? Well, it's not cool. Or, oh, it reminds me of my past. Oh, I have to touch people. You see how tender we are? Ooh, no, no. Ooh, unpleasant, unpleasant, unpleasant. And yet when we actually did it, you know, because none of us are going to, like, walk, slam the door and walk out like, screw you, Andrew. So we did it, but all of us felt like, we're here to learn how to be free. So why can't we let ourselves be free? And this was in a trusting environment where we knew that at lunch people weren't going to, like, go and, like, talk about us behind our backs and say, oh, my God, did you see what Cindy did for play? That was stupid. You know, we're all in a supportive environment, like the best possible scenario for being free, for practicing freedom, right? Best possible scenario for practicing liberation in a safe space where everybody's doing the same thing and still you're like, ooh, don't do it, you know. It's like this little kid inside you going, oh, my God, it's danger, danger, you know. Don't be free, don't be free. So imagine what we're like out in the world. Inspiration comes up. Oh, no, don't do it. Don't write that book. Oh, my God. No, don't paint that picture. We were calling to Saraswati to help us find our true expression, to express our gifts in the world. And Saraswati's like, oh, write a book. No. Oh, my God. Just people won't like me. People will make fun of it. You know, we're just tender, this little scab of fear. Because even in this kind of situation where we knew people weren't going to make fun of us, there's still some part of you saying, oh, I don't know, you know, it's weird. Won't let yourself be free even in the most perfect circumstances here. And so imagine what we're like out there. How much are you stopping yourself from being free?
So, Cindy, when
when you don't do participate in something, or you, you know, often they say, oh, but there was a lesson to be learned in the reason you didn't participate. What is it that you, you needed to learn in that moment? I just find throughout life you're always told it's a lesson. So if you haven't participated,
mm-hmm.
it's a lesson you needed to learn.
Yeah, sure.
So what lesson would you need to learn?
If you didn't participate in that exercise?
Like, why does our ego say, well, you might chat about it to someone later and I'd say, yeah, but you just weren't ready. You'll be ready soon.
Yeah.
65 years later, you're still not ready.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you have to really keep looking at what it is that you're so afraid about. I mean, and it's different, it's personal, it's different for everybody. I mean, we were talking about it in our group, so one of the things that I realised was that, and again, I don't think this is, because I know better than that. I mean, I do it. I'm not going to actually not do it. I do it, but I just now I'm able to see like all the voices coming in that, that try to stop me, but I'm not going to listen to them, you know. Like I said about the internet, like everything that can get your attention isn't actually worthy of your attention. And that's the same with the voices. All the voices saying people aren't going to like you and you're going to look like an idiot, that's not actually that important when we're doing that exercise, you know. So you have to like work out which you're going to listen to, like who's your master here, right? Have you seen Inside Out?
Yes.
Well, who in the booth up there are you going to be listening to, you know? Who are you putting in charge there? Who's the CEO of your company, right? Because mostly our company is run by the five-year-old CEO. As we developed into language and a little bit of individuation, maybe they're like 11, but they're still running the company. So you got to interview and appoint a new CEO. That's the first step towards like getting better, getting well, is having a good CEO. And then we integrate the new mission statement that is written by the CEO that's really working for the benefit of yourself and others. Okay, so you're appointing one of those awesome CEOs that run companies that are like just really caring about their employees and everything. You're finding a CEO that is going to run your company that in a way that's going to work according to your highest intentions, right? That's your mission statement. It's your highest intentions. And the highest intentions through practice begin to filter through all of the levels of the company, all the way down to the mailroom, so that everybody is behind the same mission statement. Cindy's going to get happy. You know, that's the logo. That's the mission statement. Cindy's going to be completely connected to self and others and dispel the illusion of separation. That's my mission statement. And through practice, through meditation, through deepening your intention, that starts to resonate throughout the whole of the company. So there's no moles in the company. There's no moles in the company saying, yeah, but Cindy's a loser. You're like trying to sabotage. Everybody's behind the mission statement. That's integration. That's full integration. You know, that's samadhi. Where the whole company has gotten behind the new mission statement that you've appointed through practice. So I would say, for us then, when we were talking a little bit about our experience in that group, one of the things I noticed was that the fear of not participating, it is a five-year-old's fear, and it's ridiculous, you know, please don't believe that thought. It's what I think people will think of me. How far removed is that? What I think people will think of me. Like, so I'm making up a story that there are other people that even do think of me, because when you're 20, you worry about what people think of you. When you're 40, you don't care anymore what people think of you. And when you're 60, you realise no one's ever thought of you. People rarely think of you, you know. The amount what you think people are thinking about you all the time, they're not. They're not. So, you know, I'm going to stop myself from, like, hanging out with these awesome people here and dancing around the room because I think that, like, other people, I don't know who, other people might think something about me. So I'm letting an illusion stop me from acting, you know? Does that sound ridiculous to you? It's all illusion, like a bubble, like a dream, you know, like that the mantra that it's all like a bubble, like a dream, like a star in the sky. It's just all a big illusion. We're screwing ourselves up with stories that are not true. We're telling ourselves nightmares all the time, not scary stories all the time. They're not true. So we thinking of not doing something because you think other people are going to think something about you, and who cares? Maybe they will. Are you going to stop doing something that's going to be of benefit to yourself and others because of what someone else thinks? We do it all the time, actually, but why? Why are we still living like that? Don't you have your mission statement a bit more solid than that, you know? Can't you let your own light shine? So people won't like it. Doesn't matter. You know, life is short. When you're on your deathbed, you're not going to be going, oh, I'm really glad I didn't join in participating in things that made me happy. Because I would have been really embarrassed if someone said something bad behind my back. You know, you're going to be glad you got out there and did stuff. So, yeah. Bringing awareness to the process changes everything. Just being aware of those thoughts that arise in your mind changes everything. Really does. If you're aware of them, if you don't get on the train, because getting on the train exaggerates and proliferates them and makes it real. You box it in and you lock it in and you think that's real. It's not real. It's like a brain fart that you put in a bottle and tried to, you know, make into a sculpture that's real or something. Sorry, that went. It's time for me to stop. It's a sculpture of a brain fart. Main point is...
Rogue metaphor.
That went on the train.
Are you wondering what we're thinking of you right now?
Yeah. Obviously, I need to worry more about what people think of me. No, it's actually true. Like Brené Brown, you know, you don't run your life around what other people think of you, but you also don't entirely care about what other people think of you, because the feedback you get from others helps you mirror you to see how you're doing in life. You know, if all your friends stop talking to you, you know, you might say, "Well, I don't care," but you totally care when all your friends stop talking to you. You know, there's something wrong. There's something wrong there, you know, so there is good mirroring for that, for you to see, okay, I've got to work on that. But you don't run your life around the fear of what other people are going to think and say about you either. So it's a nice balance, you know. We didn't get to it, but maybe we will tomorrow. The onion skin theory here, in terms of speech, it just shows us, like, all the different levels of our being. From our physical body, where we work on asana today. Did you feel better after asana, by chance? How weird. How weird that when you bring the body and the breath together, things start becoming more open and spacious and relaxed, and the tensions start leaving it. So the outer physical body, that starts working with the breath, the more outer prana, the breath. And that's the same sort of level as mantra, pranayama, that we do. As we go deeper in through the physical breath, we then start to feel this more subtle prana, which they call the winds. The winds are the real energies that move. The winds help us speak. The winds help us eliminate through the body. The winds help us give childbirth. The winds help us move, you know. So the winds are moving the body. So the asana helps us access the breath, which helps us access the prana. And the winds that are moving through the body, the energies, are what our thoughts ride on. So if those winds are exercised, if our energy is exercised in a way that's calm, our thoughts will be calm. So this is another way to work with the mind, through asana practice, which helps you relate to your breath, which helps you relate to your inner winds and energies. When they are calm, the mind is calm. as the mind is calm, we start to be able to access the wiring, the code. You know, we get to kind of see the code that we've written that runs our life, and we get to rewrite the code. We get to go way down deep into the code of the hard drive that is inelegant. You know, you're still running on Windows 95. You've got to update to Leopard or whatever. You know, the operating system is old. The operating system was installed when you were 11. So as you work through the winds, the thoughts, then you get right down to the base code that's working in you. That's where you get to with the Sankalpa in Yoga Nidra. You drop in things down there to rewrite the code, your intention, and that helps you get to emptiness. That helps you get to ultimate reality. Okay? Same when you are able to reach non-conceptual awareness. So after our mantra, after we've done the Oms or a Kirtan, we let the sound move us to silence. We allow the body and mind to rest in non-conceptual awareness for as long as possible. You've sung yourself into silence. Let the body and mind get flooded with non-conceptual awareness. That's knowledge. That's true knowledge. Non-conceptual awareness is true knowledge. Allow the body and mind to be flooded with that. From that, you then rewrite the code. You then, from that, your thoughts are nicely measured and beneficial and loving. From the thoughts, the winds move nice and freely. You're able to act in the world with love and compassion and awareness and no fear. From that, the breath is nice and stable. From that, the body is beautiful. Every action is an asana. See? So all works together. All these different levels of the company all working together. And speech is a main thread through all of that. Speech rides on the winds, rides on the breath. It's our thoughts. Okay? So all of that's working together, and that's yoga. So the whole company is together. The whole code has been rewritten in the most elegant way that the whole system is running easily, nicely, freely. No rogue members of the company saying, "Wait! People are going to laugh at you." Okay?